from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency yesterday after more than 50 people in the state have tested positive for the novel coronavirus, and a patient died from the illness in Placer County. The governor said the state of emergency will allow agencies to more easily share information and get equipment and services to contain the spread of coronavirus.
This proclamation, I want to point out, is not about money. It's about resourcefulness. It's about our ability to just add tools to the toolkit.
Meanwhile, a cruise ship carrying 2,500 passengers is docked off San Francisco awaiting testing kits after some aboard exhibited flu-like symptoms. We discuss the latest. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The spread of the novel coronavirus prompted California Governor Gavin Newsom to declare a state of emergency yesterday, and more than 50 people have tested positive in California across 12 counties, and a patient died from the illness in Placer County. The governor said the state of emergency will help arm officials with tools to contain the spread of coronavirus. Meanwhile, a cruise ship carrying 2,500 passengers is docked off San Francisco awaiting testing kits after some aboard exhibited flu-like symptoms. Here's Governor Newsom yesterday.
So we're holding that ship, which is thousands of passengers as well, off the coast, and we'll be conducting those tests.
And joining us to discuss the latest on the virus and how people are bracing for the spread is Erin Alday. She's a health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And before we talk about the cruise ship, let's talk about Placer County. This was a 73-year-old man, the first death in California, and it was from a cruise from Mexico. What do we know at this point about the testing kits that are going there? There are, what, about 200 that are going to be airlifted?
Yeah, so they're airlifting about 200 testing kits, which is enough to test several hundred people. Each kit can test more than one person. But yeah, the Coast Guard is dropping them off by helicopter this morning to this cruise ship that's off the coast. Last we heard, it was about a day off the coast, but it might be a little bit closer now. The latest report from the cruise itself is that it's about 100, maybe a few more than that, that will be tested, who are either, you know, passengers known or thought to have been exposed, or who are showing some kind of symptoms on that ship.
I want to get into that with some detail with you. But first, what about the man who died in Placer County? He was a 73-year-old man, as I said, and there was exposure. I mean, there was exposure to health workers. There was exposure to emergency responders, people he was on a bus with, right?
Yeah, so he became ill while on this ship. I think he was actually 71 years old, and he was on the ship when he actually started having symptoms, apparently a couple days before he offboarded. He went through the port of San Francisco while he was symptomatic, and then he got on the shuttle bus to take him back to Placer County, shared that bus with several other cruise ship passengers who were also going back home. The sense I get is that he was not feeling well and he stayed home for the next 5 days or so before calling 911 and then being transported to the hospital there in Roseville up in Placer County. So, you know, along the way, it's, you know, passengers on the cruise ship with him who could have been exposed or were exposed to the same exposure that infected him. They don't know what that was. There were people who were on that shuttle bus. There are 15 or 10 healthcare workers plus emergency responders who are now in self-isolation watching for symptoms.
Talking with Erin Alday, who is a health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, reminds me of a column you did where you said, can California contain coronavirus outbreak? Anybody's guess.
That's true. It's, I mean, very quickly in the United States, this thing is looking like it is probably already in the community. And we just don't know it because we don't have the testing capacity to, you know, test everyone who probably should be tested if we want to get a sense of just how far spread this is.
Let's hear what Governor Newsom said about testing.
If you have Medi-Cal, it's reimbursed. If you have Medicare, it's reimbursed. If you have a private health plan, it's now an essential benefit, it's reimbursed. That is very significant. So people should not feel any anxiety about requesting and demanding the test.
Well, that's the governor, and he seems to be on top of it. What's your perception, Erin?
Well, you know, I mean, he says that people should be demanding tests, but my impression is that that's not really the case at all. People, you know, No, but they're not. They're only testing people who are very seriously ill at this point, or who have a known exposure to coronavirus. So, you know, if you are having flu-like symptoms now, if you have a fever, if you have a cough, if you have any reason to think you might have coronavirus, and you call up your doctor, they're not going to test you at this point. And I'm getting a lot of calls and emails from people out in the community who are very concerned, who want to know if they have this virus, if only because they want to know if they should stay home and isolate, if they should not go to work, you know, how they should respond to this. And there's just – we just do not have the capacity to test everyone who wants to or probably should be tested.
Well, the governor has also been suggesting and actually strongly emphasizing that there has to be partnership between local, state, and federal. To what extent are we moving toward that kind of partnership or realizing it?
Well, I think that there are – I mean, there certainly are partnerships. You know, anytime a new case is realized, you know, the county is handling certain aspects of that. The state is handling aspects. CDC, you look at this cruise ship and it's, you know, it's everybody's on board, every, you know, in terms of public health officials. They're all kind of working together to handle the situation.
In fact, excuse me, the CDC is meeting up with the cruise ship along with public health officials and the Coast Guard. Yeah,
correct. Yeah. Well, they're all meeting together to figure out what to do with it. It's out at sea and figure out how to get these people back home. But as far as, you know, getting testing kits and figuring out who should be tested, there's a lot of differing kind of opinions out there. There's a lot of frustration at the county and state level that they can't do all the testing they want to do because the CD hasn't made enough of these kits. And meanwhile, there aren't enough other manufacturers to produce more kits. And I mean, people are saying we should be testing millions and we're not anywhere close to that.
Let me ask you about the federal government response. President Trump's statements seem to be contradicting his own health officials. I mean, that's been pretty consistent, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. He's been downplaying it, and that's not the impression you're getting from any public health officials.
But they're up to about $8 billion now, whereas they started with $2.5. I mean, this has at least moved up to the degree that it was originally asked for by Chuck Schumer.
Correct. You know, the folks I talked to don't seem overly concerned about the financial kind of that there's going to be that financial support. I think the bigger concern is, you know, getting kind of rallying the resources. You know, you can have all the money, but if you can't get enough face masks because, you know, there's international production lines are broken down or we're working through the stockpile or we're starting to get into the stockpile. You know, if you can't manufacture enough test kits, that at some point doesn't come down to having the money to pay for it. It just comes down to, you know, having the time and the resources.
What can you tell us about the resources? I mean, in terms of an overview.
I mean, I know that there's definitely concern that we're running out of face masks. We're telling regular people don't buy these things, partly because they're not very useful, but partly because we need to use those in public health settings. We need to have our frontline healthcare providers have enough of these masks to use. So that's one issue, certainly. And I know that there's, you know, just concerns about other protective gear, that we're going to have enough supply of that. And then, of course, if this thing really takes off and we end up with a lot of people hospitalized, you know, they're saying right now that we have the capacity for that. But I know that a lot of people are concerned that if we get thousands, tens of thousands, more than that, people sick all at the same time, that's going to be a real strain.
What happens, for example, or what has happened in Santa Clara County where there are three new cases? I mean, suddenly is there a major run on resources and attempt to get tests, even though they're not available as they should be in many people's minds?
I don't know that there's so much a run on resources. I think they've been pretty good about getting that message out. Certainly a lot of people requesting test kits, a lot of people in the community that are wondering about that. But, you know, again, it's simply saying, sorry, no, we don't have them. I think right now in places like Santa Clara County and other local health departments is they're the ones that have to do all this contact tracing. So when they have a new person who tests positive, they now have to find hundreds, potentially thousands of contacts of each person.
We're talking again with Erin Alday. She's here with us in studio. She's a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I know there are many of you who have questions. And so let me give you the number now that you can join us at. It is a toll-free number. And the number to call is 866-733-6786. Number again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Erin, could I ask you to speak briefly about BART, because they're taking some extra safety measures, I know.
Yeah, I think that was just coming out last night or this morning. you know, mostly they're doing extra disinfecting is my impression. They've kind of amped that up. They're doing that more often. They're also talking about, you know, putting hand washing stations, hand sanitizing stations at, you know, all or most stations. But I don't know that, you know, they've said much more than that in terms of, you know, the big question is what happens if somebody, you know, a known case is known to have been on BART, and how that will be handled. You know, and also just in the long term, if we start really enacting social distancing measures and telling people to stay away from large crowds, you know, I get this question a lot. The first thing that people will think of is BART. Should I be taking BART to work anymore? Should I be taking BART, you know, home? And I think that, you know, that's something that I'm getting the sense we're going to address when and if that time comes.
Well, that brings me to Bill Hanage. Professor Bill Hanage is Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Department of Epidemiology and a faculty member in the Center for Communicative Disease Dynamics at Harvard University. He's not an MD, but I think he can answer a lot of questions that many of you have and that are floating around in my consciousness. Good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I guess the first question, sort of dovetailing on what we just heard from Aaron Alde, is you're making a distinction between containment and, as I said earlier, Aaron had an article say, title was, Can California Contain Coronavirus Outbreak? It's anybody's guess. But you're saying there's kind of a trajectory here. We're going to go from containment or efforts at containment to mitigation.
Yeah, I mean, and when you are first trying to deal with an infectious disease outbreak, obviously you want to try and contain it. You want to try and keep a lid on it, and you want to keep it to a manageable number of cases. But once it gets beyond a certain extent, then you want to shift to a whole different set of measures. When you're talking about containment, it's all about the contact tracing. It's all about trying to keep things as small as possible. But once you get beyond a certain point, then you have to sort of take more population health measures, which looks more like social distancing.
Well, speaking of social distancing, there are always questions about how people should how many feet you should stay away from somebody who's coughing or sneezing. Those kind of questions are just very practical questions. But I think you pointed out there's been some good work by the World Health Organization. They've given us a strong sense of social distancing, and that can really make a difference.
Yeah, social distancing will make a difference. I mean, we have to remember that if you look at the detailed sort of studies of transmission that we have been able to achieve so far, it's relatively close contacts which are at the highest risk. So if you reduce your numbers of close contacts, then you can actually do a lot to protect yourself.
No hugs or handshakes is a good rule, a good caveat to live by?
I would definitely recommend avoiding hugs and handshakes. If you need to shake hands, you can do the kind of Ebola handshake, which is like touching elbows together. Well, there's a whole bunch of different alternatives. I mean, you know, as you can tell from my accent, I'm British, so I'm kind of cool with this kind of, you know, preserve.
Stiff upper lip, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Stiff upper lip. Don't get too close to people and don't show too much emotion. But if people do that in general, then it's actually a pretty good thing. The other recommendation is hand washing. If you wash your hands, every time you get into the house, just wash your hands for 20 seconds. Change your clothes. Do that. Wash your hands on a regular basis throughout the day. If you see a hand sanitizing station, hey, you know, why not use a little bit of it? And if you do that kind of stuff, then you're going to be able to not only help protect yourself, but if you can stop yourself getting infected, then you're going to be doing a service to your community as well.
Well, since you mentioned your British pedigree, I have to ask you, there's word coming out of the BBC that there are two strains of coronavirus. Can you illuminate that for us or speak about it?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit too early to say. One of the interesting things about the genetics of this virus is that they're all very, very, very similar to each other, which reflects the fact that they've only been circulating in humans for a few months. They haven't had enough time to pick up mutations. So the report suggests that there is a different strain associated with severe disease. But I personally think it's a bit early to be able to draw in those conclusions. I mean, the difficulty is, just from a scientific perspective, if you happen to have a particular mutation in an area which is having a lot of severe disease, either because healthcare systems have been overwhelmed, it's really hard to see if it's the mutation which is causing it. So you'd actually need a lot more studies and a lot more science to be done on it. But people are monitoring this right now.
Well, what do we know, at least about the genomes at this point, or about, for that matter, the evolution of the disease?
What we know is that there's not a lot of variation which has accumulated so far. I mean, I've been used to looking at these sort of family trees that you make of genome sequences and seeing things which are different at tens or thousands of different positions in their genomes. And here, we're looking at a handful. I mean, it really does seem to descend from a point somewhere around November So it's only been around within humans for a couple of months.
There are a lot of people who want to talk with you and have questions for you and for our guest in studio, Aaron Alday, and I'm going to give people an opportunity in just a moment. But I'd like you, if you could, Professor, and this is Bill Hanage, who's with us from Harvard, if you could give us a sense of, well, traveling. I mean, at this point, I think it's important to recognize that international travel should be done advisedly, to say the least, especially in certain parts of the world like Italy or Japan. But people are confused, and they're sort of trying to sort through it all. Can you give us some advice here?
That's right. I completely understand that people are confused. So there are certain regions of the world where we know that there's a large amount of transmission going on, and those include places like Italy at the moment. China's actually probably got less transmission. They've been actually reintroducing cases from Italy into China recently. If you're planning on traveling somewhere, most parts of the world, it's fine. I don't think there's a major problem, but with the major proviso that things are changing quickly. So, you know, Italy was not on anybody's radar until comparatively recently. So you should be prepared to, you should be prepared for there to be a rapidly changing situation, and that can happen for quite some time. The other thing I want to point out is that there are, I, for instance, myself was due to be speaking at a meeting this week in Denver, and last week I decided I was not going to go to it because I didn't feel like I, as an epidemiologist, could be giving the example of going to this meeting and rubbing shoulders with lots of people from all over the world. And then, in fact, after I said I was going to send a video of my talk, the whole meeting was cancelled. So I would start thinking very carefully about going to large-scale events. We know that things like Milan Fashion Week contributed to some of the transmission, and we have seen governments around the world starting to take tough decisions to scale some of these events down.
You say mass gatherings may be inadvisable, aren't you?
I think that at some point we're going to have to get to the point where mass gatherings are definitively, you know, not advisable. And we've got lessons from history here. Now, you probably know that the 1918-1919 flu pandemic is probably the worst infectious disease emergency any of us are, you know, have heard of, maybe excepting the Black Death. There's some very interesting work that has shown that those communities which started to shut down the gatherings of people earlier actually did better. So I'm not saying this is 1918-19, by the way. I'm really not saying that we're in that particular type of territory, but that illustrates how important and how valuable it can be to take prompt action when it comes to large gatherings of people.
Professor Bill Hanage with us, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard. And let's go to a caller, and we begin, Hunter, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
With a lot of unknowns, I'm just wondering, when should we consider not going to work? I know that's been on a lot of people's minds in the Bay Area, especially. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Bill Hanage?
Thanks, Hunter. That's a really good question, and it's one which is a bit tough to answer. The thing which is tough is that not everybody is in the same situation because, you know, for me, I can pretty much work from home, but that's not true of everybody. My personal feeling is to check out with your local public health authorities, and what they need to be looking at, what they should be being very careful of, is evidence of community transmission. So I personally feel that we also have to get an element of perspective here. Even if we reckon that this is going to be with us for some time, and I think it will, your risk on every individual day is actually quite low. Because if you assume that you were to get it at some point over the next 2 years, chances are it wouldn't be tomorrow. So if you have little evidence of community transmission, then I think that it's fine to be going to work. But I would add to that, you know, try to avoid shaking hands, don't hug people, do your kind of your elbow handshake, and wash your hands when you come into the house, wash your hands when you get to work, and so on and so forth.
And another caller joins us. It's Sherry. Sherry, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just had a comment and a question about the governor said that these kits and treatment will be reimbursed, but Medi-Cal patients won't ever participate in reimbursement. Like, they don't have the money to pay up front and then hope that it gets approved later. And so I'm just really wondering if there's going to be more of an effort, like outreach, you know, now they're saying there's not going to be enough hospital beds. Like, are they going to get cruise ships, make those into extra hospitals? Or, you know, how can we really make this work so that people don't have transmission instead of, you know, letting it spread throughout the community through all this contact?
Sherry, thank you for that question. Erin Aldie.
So I think in terms of, you know, who's going to pay for this, you know, when it comes to the test kits right now, because there are so few, the test kits are really being used so sporadically, and those are being covered. I mean, that's just, you know, they're only testing people for very specific purposes so they can figure out who's sick and, you know, who's very sick and then trace their contacts. And I think once they expand testing, you know, that will also be covered because it will be used largely for surveillance purposes just to find out how widespread this is and less for the individual. I think one thing people need to keep in mind as far as testing goes is we don't have any particular treatments for this. So even if you test positive, I mean, right now that won't be the difference between being told to isolate yourself at home and being kind of allowed out in the community. But, you know, as this thing progresses, we may not have that, you know, stringent of rules in place. And so getting a coronavirus test, you know, result positive won't necessarily mean a lot to any given individual. You wouldn't do anything any different than if you had influenza. You would stay home while you're not feeling well and just drink lots of fluids and take care of yourself. As for, you know, where we're going to care for people, I know that is certainly something that is on people's minds. And again, it comes back to if we get a lot of illness all at once, where are we going to treat everybody? And that's something they're thinking about now. And, I, you know, we're not going to be putting people on cruise ships out at sea in beds. But, you know, up in Seattle, they, I think, are renting a hotel to put people who are positive, who need to be watched.
Erin Aldie, again, is health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. We're coming up on a break here, but let me go back to you, Professor Hanage, if I could, with a question from a listener named Charles who says, if you've been exposed to COVID-19, do you develop immunities or only if you develop the disease?
That's another good question. Based on what we know about other coronaviruses, you would expect to develop some immunity, and we would expect it to last for a reasonable period of time, at least a year or so. There have been some reports where it appears superficially like people have been positive and then they have been negative and then they've been positive again. But I think that probably reflects issues with the testing procedure. At the moment, we don't have a proper setting of how, a proper idea of how good immunity is and how long it will last. But like I say, by analogy with other coronaviruses, you'd expect immunity and you'd expect it to last for a while.
We're speaking to Professor Bill Hanage, who is Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Department of Epidemiology. He's a faculty member in the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Erin Aldie is with us in studio as well, health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. You can join us if you have questions about coronavirus in California. Please feel free to be part of the program. You can call us now at our toll-free number. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, your calls, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California Governor Newsom has declared a state of emergency for coronavirus here in California, and we have experience in the state the first death in Placer County. We are taking your calls for our guests, Erin Aldie of the San Francisco Chronicle, who's a health reporter there, and Bill Hanage, who is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard. Let me go to Robert. Robert, you're on. Morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. It's a question for Dr. Hanick. I'm a retired physician. I should know this, but I don't. Is there any existing antiviral that is effective against coronavirus, or is treatment purely supportive?
Line is not good, but did you catch that, Bill Hanage?
Yes, I did.
He wants to know if there's actually any existing antiviral against coronavirus.
There are none that we know of to be effective at the moment. There have been various, people have been trying to use various from other viruses. There are a couple which you might use on HIV based on the fact, essentially, that, you know, it's also an RNA virus. But we don't have good data on whether or not they're actually, doing any good. So the treatment is pretty much completely supportive.
Let me thank Robert for his call and go right to another caller. That's you, Amanda. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering what temperatures the virus survives at and if there are any countries or climates or seasons when it won't spread as fast.
What do we know about that, Bill Hannage? What do we know at this point?
That's a super question. The short answer is that we don't think it's going to be slowed down very much by differences in temperature. The reason we think that is that if you look at the sort of takeoff, as it were, of the virus in different parts of China, that covers quite a lot of different climates. There's a lot of range of humidity and quite a lot of different temperatures, and you can see that it's been doing pretty well in most of them. And this is also what you'd expect if you look at the other seasonal coronaviruses, because you know we already have two coronaviruses which make us sick, although not spectacularly sick. You know, we get outbreaks of them every winter, and they go away in the spring. And that's probably because of immunity. There is almost certainly some impact of the changing weather, but it's the changing weather plus the immunity. So if we imagine that sort of thing happen, if we imagine that sort of thing happened with the current coronavirus, we would expect it to continue to increase in the summer months, but maybe at a slower pace. The important distinction is it's not just the weather that makes things go away. It's the weather plus immunity.
Let me thank the caller for the question, and let me go back to you, Aaron Alday, with a question from a listener named Stephen, and we're getting a lot of questions on this. He says, I haven't heard anything about the state planning to do drive-through testing as they are doing in other parts of the world. Is there any plan to put something like this in place, especially in the Bay Area? I think it would be important.
I think a lot of people would agree that would be important. Again, it comes back to we just don't have nearly enough kits. I think that Governor Newsom said last night that the state has 5,900 testing kits now, which is a huge increase from last week when there were about 1,200. And the state only really started testing, keep in mind, I think a week ago today. So last Thursday was when the first state and county labs got their kits from the CDC. So this is all brand new. It's even if as we get more CDC kits, we're going to have to scale up from there. So I think a lot of people would love to do drive-by testing, would love to just put this thing out and test everybody and really get a sense of what's out there. But we're a ways from that.
I mentioned the other day that I had occasion to talk with Congresswoman Jackie Speier, and she was concerned about the fact that, for example, in South Korea, there are so many testing kits available. I mean, why are we so behind the eight ball here?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. I think that's kind of one of the most important questions right now because it keeps being held up. You know, I think nationwide, we're looking at about 150 positive cases so far, confirmed cases. And that's sort of held up as, you know, well, we're not doing that bad here in the United States compared to other places. But there are lots of people that think it's just because we're not testing. And, you know, if we were to do this widespread, that we would find out this thing is kind of all over the place. And we're actually looking at, you know, an outbreak level that's similar to a lot of other countries.
Dr. Hannage, I have another question from a listener named Kira for you. She writes, I have two young children. Would I need to quarantine myself from them if I were to get it? When does a quarantine become an incubator if an infected person is to lock down with healthy people?
Thanks. Again, a good question. The thing to know about children is that with this infection, children are a bit weird, to put it.
Well, they're not as vulnerable. The older you get, the more vulnerable you are, yeah?
They don't seem to get severe disease. Yeah. The initial series of patients and cases that we've been looking at, children are noticeable by their absence. And that's probably not because they don't get infected. We're beginning to see evidence from longer case series where people have been testing more intensively in parts of China that were not subject to the kind of explosive outbreak in Wuhan, which completely overwhelmed healthcare. And if you look there, you can see that children are potentially infected, but again, typically with very mild symptoms. So I understand your concern for your children. I completely understand that. But I think this is a more difficult question. Rather than worrying about our kids getting infected, it's important for the role of school closures as a way of mitigating the outbreak or the epidemic. Because if children can be infected and be infectious, then closing schools would be a really important thing to stop them turning into sort of fountains of virus, spreading it in the community.
Here's a caller on topic. Anu, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Just to follow up on the last comment, you know, I have two elementary school children and we receive routine communication from the school. The question is, we live in Santa Clara County. At what point do you think it's appropriate to shut down schools?
Big question. I'm going to go to you, Bill Hannage.
Thanks for the question. It's a really difficult one. And it's one which I think is going to have to be made by public health departments all around the country. Personally, I am moving, and this is now I'm talking about my opinion. My opinion is that we should seriously consider closing schools once we suspect community transmission. Of course, when I say community transmission, there's a good question, how much community transmission and all of that sort of thing. So, and those are very difficult questions to answer. But I would also come back to what Aaron was just saying. A crucial thing that we need are tests and testing kits, because unless you turn on the light, you can't see what's there.
Aaron, what's the update here in the Bay Area on schools? A number of them are closed.
The only schools that have closed in the Bay Area so far are places where a student or staff member has, I don't even think has been diagnosed positive, but has been identified as a close contact of somebody who's tested positive. And it's very short-term closures at this point, like a week or so. So I think there was a school up in Sonoma County. There was a school on the peninsula somewhere. I think there's a school in Oakland now that is closed.
What about in Placer County?
Placer County, at this point, they are keeping schools open, last I heard. But I know that the health officer up in Placer County, she definitely remarkably yesterday told her community that I no longer think that this is a low risk for the public. That's the first time. Yeah, that was pretty, you know, we haven't heard that from a public health officer, you know, yet. I think she was the first to really come out and say that. And in fact, the state public health department kind of took issue with that a little bit later in the day, suggested that that wasn't the case. But, you know, I thought that was a bold statement. And I think, you know, they weren't closing schools at that time, but I imagine that those are conversations they're having up there.
And when Governor Newsom declared the state in an emergency situation, he also pointed out, and there are airport workers in LAX who have been exposed to the virus, I think six of them, that this is no longer North or South. This is the state of California. Let me get another caller on here, and that's James. James, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I just haven't heard anything about local tourism. I do some guiding here in San Francisco. We do small groups every day in the Yosemite to Napa, in, you know, small 15-passenger vans, hiking together. And there's a sizable amount of companies in San Francisco that do trips every day, and there's been no discussion about that, and people are flying in from airports every day, getting on the next morning on one of our trips. And I'm just curious, anything, you know, talk about that, or is that just kind of keep going until, you know, something happens and someone gets the coronavirus and then it's going to be talked about? Or
you mean in a reactive sense as opposed to a preventive sense? Aaron, you're hearing any talk about tour buses?
You know, not specifically about that, but I know that those, again, are some of the conversations that are being had. Whenever you're talking about, you know, shutting down, you know, saying people should stop doing that, you know, you have to take in the social and economic repercussions, right? So, I mean, these are not decisions that can be made in a vacuum or made lightly. So, you know, for every single one of these cases or these situations, these questions, they have to think, well, what's going to be the repercussions and what is going to be the benefit from that? Is that going to accomplish anything? So I think that those kinds of questions are being asked pretty much constantly by public health folks right now. But yeah, the answer is that right now, no, they're not stopping any of that. Will they at some point? I mean, maybe.
Aaron, all day.
Yeah, I don't know about stop it. I mean, it's a little nerve-wracking. I know there's nothing discussed at the companies I work for. And every morning I'm kind of looking at people and saying, where'd you come from? Where'd you fly from? And it's on my mind, but there's nothing I can do about it other than don't go to work. So, yeah.
I'm sorry you're going through that anxiety. I can certainly understand it, James. I hope that maybe someone will hear what you have to say here this morning and perhaps act on it if it hasn't already been acted upon. And I thank you for the call. And again, Aaron Alday is health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. And Bill Hannage is also with us, associate professor of epidemiology at Harvard. Question for you from a listener named Trish. Bill just says, along the supply chain, products must be handled by hundreds of people. Is there any risk of becoming infected by handling our groceries, cans, cartons, etc.? Might products ordered online carry the virus into our homes upon delivery?
There is, I think that to emphasize here the role of close contacts. No majority of transmission happens among close contacts. And this is something which, you know, epidemiologists often find themselves thinking about, the difference between something happening at all and something happening often enough that you'd be really worried about it. So Trish is absolutely right. We have this, we live in this vastly connected world where the, everything we handle has so many different sort of possible people having handled it before. And there is a small risk that a person who was particularly infected or infectious might have handled it, and it could have actually come into someone's home and infect them. But it's a small risk. You know, as I say, the great majority of transmission that we know about from what we have studied happens between relatively close contacts. And so rather than at this stage, when still the risk per day is pretty low, I don't think we need to be sort of, you know, spraying viricides over everything that we're buying over the internet.
I want to bring Jeff Smith into our conversation. He's a county executive of Santa Clara County. He's also an MD. And Jeff, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd like an update from you. Cases in Santa Clara, how many are we up to, and what about the origin of those cases?
Well, we've identified 17 cases, and I would say basically about 60%. We've worked out all of the transmissions and contacts. The others we're actively working right now. There have been identified four in the last 2 days, so those obviously are new. The majority of the transmissions have been, as your previous guest said, from close contact, I mean family contact with known other infected individuals, and the primary source has been from travel, people who have traveled to risky locations. We have had a couple of community transmissions, which really just means, you know, in the parlance of the public health world, it means that these are confirmed cases that have not had an identified direct contact. And so we're watching those very closely to try to identify what the risks are there.
We were talking, Jeff, just a bit ago about school closures. Can you let us know what the county is doing also about school closures?
Yes. The issue of school closures is a very challenging issue because it's a very intense intervention in the community, causes lots of disruption, and actually causes risk on its own because you then have kids and staff, you know, away from contact areas where they information can be transmitted effectively. What we're recommending right now is that we only consider, not actually close, but only consider closure in a situation where there's a documented infection of a child or a teacher or worker in the school, and we don't have any of those identified as of yet. But if we do, we'll move ahead to considering closure.
Well, we wish you the best in terms of moving ahead, and I appreciate very much your being with us this morning and updating us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Jeff Smith. He's a county executive in Santa Clara County, also an MD. And let me go to more of your calls, and we go to Faye Ruiz. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a my husband is immunocompromised. He has an autoimmune condition. He gets the flu vaccine every year, and he has had the pneumonia vaccine. So if he were to come down with COVID, would the pneumonia vaccine serve as like another layer of immunity, or are there other things that he can do to sort of protect himself? I mean, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Okay. Now, I should say Bill Hannage is with us. He is an epidemiologist, not an MD, but can you shed some light here, Bill?
I certainly can. Faye, that's great. I'm so glad to hear that he has been seeking the protection of vaccines. So there are two ways in which having a flu shot and also the pneumonia vaccine might help. The first and perhaps most important, is that if you fall ill, then it's, you know, you can sort of say, well, it's unlikely to be flu. That's a good thing to know. The other thing is that it may keep him away from going into doctor's offices or other places where possibly there could be an elevated risk of transmission. But finally, it's quite possible, we don't know very much about this yet, but if you look at people who have more severe outcomes, some of it may be due to bacterial co-infections. So the way to think about it is that the coronavirus comes along and sort of, you know, does a little bit of damage, and then that allows bacteria to get a foothold and to start growing, and you end up having disease from the bacteria as well. And one of the pathogens that might be doing that is the pneumococcal is a pneumococcus, and the vaccine which you're talking about should help protect against that. So he's done really well for himself.
Let me thank you, Fairuz, and good luck to your husband and to your family on that. Let me bring another caller aboard, and that's Emily. Emily, join us.
Hi. So I'm calling because I've been home for about 5 days feeling pretty sick. I talked to my doctor, and we're pretty sure it's flu, it sounds like. But either way, I should be staying home. And I'm curious at what point it's safe for me to go back into work because, I mean, after 5 days, it starts to become a problem being home.
Have you heard anything, Aaron, from public health officials on that kind of advice?
You know, the irony is that's a story I'm working on right now. So I'm going to be interviewing people this afternoon about exactly that question. In fact, I have colleagues that are facing that exact same question right now, which is that they have those symptoms and they're staying home wisely, but they're really not sure when it is safe to come back. So maybe your other guest has.
Well, let me go to you, Bill Hanisch. Have some thoughts for us on this?
I think that it's a really good question. Firstly, congratulations for self-isolating. I think that it's a really good thing to do, and you know, your community thanks you. When it's safe to go back to work, it's very difficult to know because we know that people who are infected with coronavirus can be shedding virus for what seems like quite a long period of time. So at the moment, again, people in your position, I wish they could receive a test, because if you could receive a test and if those could be rolled out to you, then we can start dealing with that issue. And it's one of the major parts of keeping the economy of this country running.
And another listener asks, how safe is the gym, Bill Hanisch?
So the gym is going to be safe in the same way like anywhere else is safe, which is that, you know, you avoid people who have obviously got respiratory symptoms. You know, the major symptoms of coronavirus infection are a dry cough and fever. And if you have a dry cough and fever, hopefully you won't be going to the gym. People in the gym are, you know, you're going to be in contact with individuals there, but it's just the same as you would be anywhere else. You know, wash your hands, you know, maybe wipe down the equipment before you use it or something like that. Those small steps to reduce the contact between yourself and possible places of getting the virus. But the thing I want to say again is most transmission occurs among close contacts. I'm trying to say this because I want everybody to be, I want to be abundantly clear. This is a very serious situation, but it's also a situation which we can do a lot about, and we can do a lot to help ourselves and others.
And speaking about doing a lot, good citizenship would almost require people de rigueur to maybe consider self-quarantining, but in too many instances, people don't know necessarily that they have the coronavirus. They may have symptoms, and any advice or any light you can just shed on the whole notion of when you should self-quarantine and how much you should be at least advised to self-quarantine?
In my view, anybody who has had contact with a known case should be self-quarantining until they have a test which shows that they are negative. I mean, this is, you know, tough, but it's something which is necessary in order to prevent the virus establishing itself within our communities. If you are sick and if you have symptoms, you can, of course, try and get tested for other viruses. And if it turns out that it is flu, then, okay, we can stand down. But if it isn't and you don't know what it is, then the maximum amount of quarantine that you can do. And also, I should point out, there is a real role here for public health authorities to try and communicate the importance of quarantine, because many people may not understand exactly what it is or why it is necessary, and it is a tough thing. I mean, we should point out that we have seen cases in history where quarantine has backfired because people have tried to find their way around it. But in this case, if we want to try and stop coronavirus as much as we can, quarantining or self-isolation is an extremely important part of that.
Aaron, all day, Bill Hanage mentions public health authorities. I mean, they do play a crucial role in this. Talk about the hierarchy here. I mean, they're answerable to others.
Yeah, so it's it is pretty interesting. So, you know, you have the on kind of the top level, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, you know, is monitoring this and giving out kind of overarching guidance on what providers should do, who should be testing, that kind of thing. And then you have the state health departments are sort of figuring out, you know, obviously what to do on a statewide level and making some calls. But really, a lot of what we're talking about in terms of school closures and social distancing and contact tracing and putting, you know, asking people to self-quarantine, that's coming to down to the county public health departments. And so a lot of this work is really falling on their shoulders to keep tabs on this, to communicate to their communities.
The shoulders are very heavy now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of work for departments that are frankly under a lot of strain right now.
We'll bring another caller on. That's you, Wally. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Thank you. My concern is with my 90-year-old mother and her 88-year-old brother, my uncle, who are planning on taking a cruise to Mexico in the middle of April. And your thoughts on whether I should pressure them to cancel their cruise or not, because they're being very adamantly resistant to any kind of thought of not going.
Well, the Princess Cruise also did have a stop in Mexico, Aaron, also Hawaii, but it's very difficult to really firmly say at this point, isn't it? What would you advise him?
I mean, if it were my parents, I would tell them not to do it.
Yeah, that's what I was seeing in your facial expressions. Bill Hanage, you want to weigh in?
I think I'd be in the same position. I mean, they sound like great people. I'm sure they have very big personalities and that they're very stubborn. But I would not, and I would advise my parents to not do that. The other thing to note is that April is actually quite some way away. By that stage, I think that things like this may well have become moot. I also want to comment, cruise ships in general have really difficult places when it comes to infections. We know that from norovirus outbreaks. And of course, the Diamond Princess was a cruise ship which for a period of time at least actually had its own line listing, you know, and had more cases than most countries. So cruise ships right now are something that I would not be encouraging my parents to go on.
Someone, I don't know who the wag was who said this, but they're like Petri dishes. I think that's probably apropos. Here's a listener, as long as we're giving some advice to listeners, and boy, there are a lot of callers and listeners who want advice. This is Vikram who says, my mom, who is 65, is thinking of traveling from India to California in May for 1 month. Given her age, long travel, and the situation in Santa Clara, which I believe you heard, Professor Hanage, official county official with us, would it be better for her not to travel? And I think the advice again, probably, yeah.
And these are very, you know, people all over the country and all over the world are having to make decisions like this. At the moment, it's hard to predict exactly what will be happening in May. But one of the things which is quite interesting, if we look at the global situation, and this illustrates it, we're pivoting from a situation where folks were worried about Wuhan or China or South Korea to a point where people are starting to be worried about California. And this illustrates that this is a genuine global problem. May is too far out to be forecasting, but all I can encourage is people to, you know, watch the news and, you know, update their decisions accordingly.
Actually, interesting question from a listener named Tina. This is a little off the course of what we've been talking about for most of this hour, but she says, is it time maybe to pressure countries where people eat wild animals or keep them as pets? Some thoughts, Bill Hanage?
There have been suggestions that the traditional sort of Chinese markets where there are many different species kept together could be a public health risk. Of course, the original SARS, you know, the first version back in 2003 emerged from one of these markets, and this current outbreak seems to be linked to one, although I will caution that, saying that the very first case of which I'm aware actually reported no contact with the market. I believe that the authorities in China may be looking at this, but again, it's difficult because there is a strong cultural component to this, and so it'll have to be handled sensitively.
And another caller joins us. That's you, Molly. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm 5 months pregnant, and I was curious if there's an understanding of how vulnerable newborns and infants might be versus children who seem to be less vulnerable.
Erin, can you help us here?
I think that's something that they're still figuring out. I mean, this thing is so new.
I've been getting people shrugging their shoulders when it comes to this question of pregnancy.
Yeah, and, you know, in fact, one of my colleagues is working on that story right now. She's been researching this because we've been hearing a lot of that question from people. And unfortunately, I don't know where her reporting is at. But I know that, I mean, obviously that's something anytime you get a new disease, that's one of the first questions is what about people who are pregnant? And I don't know right now.
Molly, I wish we could give you more information. At this point, anything to add on that, Bill Hanage?
No, I really don't. Erin covered it very well. I mean, unfortunately, whenever something emerges, you have to build up an evidence base with which to make recommendations. And right now, we are very early on in that process.
Well, we've certainly learned a lot thanks to our guests. I want to express appreciation to you, Bill Hanage, for being with us this hour. I thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to all of the listeners who called in.
And thanks to Erin Alde, who's here with us in studio. Appreciate your being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Erin Alde is health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Ariana Prale, Blanca Torres, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Interns are Michael King and Jameson Weiss. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this opening hour. Another hour up ahead. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.